87-year-old Joseph Epstein, a longtime essayist for the Wall Street Journal, has written his autobiography called Never Say You've Had a Lucky Life, Especially If You've Had a Lucky Life. Mr. Epstein spent 20 years as editor of the American Scholar and 30 years teaching in the English department at Northwestern University. Early in this newest of over 30 books, he writes, I feel extremely lucky in all these realms in which I had no choice. Parents, epic, country, and throw in religion, city, and social class.
Hi, it's Kayla from C-SPAN. Imagine 45 years ago when there was just a handful of television networks. C-SPAN first went on the air bringing an unfiltered view of government directly to America's living rooms. No spin, no commentary, just pure democracy in action.
And it's Greta from C-SPAN. It was a bold experiment. We finally had a front row seat to Congress, the White House, and the campaign trail, all without government funding.
As we celebrate 45 years and a legacy of unfiltered access, we ask for your support of a donation in honor of our four decades of service. Your gift, no matter how big or small, will help maintain this vital resource for access to the democratic process.
You can help ensure another 45 years of witnessing history unfold and empowering citizens to be informed and engaged in the political process. Visit cspan.org/donate today and join our 45th anniversary campaign.
Thank you for supporting C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make your gift of support. Thank you.
Joseph Epstein, why did you have a picture on the flap of your new book that shows you riding a bicycle, somebody's house, riding it down the hallway?
Well, it's riding a unicycle, let me correct you immediately, which shows what a skillful fellow I am. You know, I included that picture just to show that life itself amuses me. And, you know, I'm a juggler also, you should know. So I hope I've established myself with you right at the outset as a serious person, a juggler and a unicyclist.
When did you decide to write an autobiography?
I think I decided roughly 2 years ago. And the question, you know, I deal with, in the book, as you know, with my not being the most perfect candidate for autobiography, since there's nothing all that notable in my accomplishments or my life. I'm a man who, for the most part, his life has been spectatorial. That is to say, I've been on the sidelines, amused by the circus of life as it's gone around me. But I have not had any major achievements, both in politics and history, or much else, alas.
Let me read you a paragraph from your book. Each morning during my high school years, I woke with nothing but pleasant prospects awaiting. Gambling, whoring, bugging, smoking, laughing, lots of laughing, freedom from responsibility. High school was paradise. Explain that.
It was. Yes, yeah, so those. It's been downhill all the way.
What kind of a student were you in high school?
I could tell you precisely what kind of student I was. In a February class of 213 students, I finished 169th, just above the lower quarter.
You know, you tell us a lot about the failings in your life in the book. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, which failings do you have in mind? I'm pleased that you brought that up, because I'm afraid that I feared in writing it that I was bragging about myself or preening. But which failings do you
I'll take an example of, if I remember right, you got kicked out of the University of Illinois.
That's true. I felt, well, it was a decisive moment in my life, because having been kicked out of Illinois, which I got into, by the way, in those days, Illinois had what was essentially open enrollment. You could have five felonies and graduate last in your class. They had to take you at the University of Illinois on probation, to be sure, but they did take you. and my getting kicked out of Illinois in some way sent me to Chicago, which was a decisive, the University of Chicago, which was decisive in my life. So I felt it ought to be accounted for. Whether people will, you know, I was kicked out, as you know, for selling an accounting exam that somebody else had stolen and asked me to sell it for him. That they came to me showed that my, you know, my MO was that of a kind of general hustler in those days.
And
you know, a man who had his own bookie, you know, a 19-year-old with his own bookie.
How did you get into the University of Chicago?
Well, in those days, we were very lucky. I think I can include you in this, too, at your august age of, I won't mention how august your age is.
No, I'm 82. That's
okay. But those of us who were born in the late Depression and shortly thereafter are a low population cohort. And, you know, parents were nervous after the Depression about having children. They had them late. They had fewer of them. And consequently, the colleges and universities wanted us because there were fewer of us than normal. I remember when I had applied to the University of Chicago, and I hadn't heard from them, and I went over one day to say I was trying to make plans. Is there any word on my application? And a man named Robert Strozier, dean of students, said, "Wait a minute." He went to the file cabinet and he filed through it. And he said, "Oh yeah, you can come." That's how charmingly informal it was in those days. When I think of today, poor Silicon Valley children commit suicide because they don't get into Yale. And so, you know, we were very lucky, I think. And also, though, Chicago had a kind of dubious reputation in those days. Now, this is 1956, and in those days, it had a slight reputation of being pinko, which is to say, communist. It wasn't, of course, but Robert Hutchins had put down the McCarthyites and others. So it was a strange place to go to. It turned out to be a wonderful place for me. As I say, it was one of the turning points of my life is having gone there.
Why?
Because it gave me this idea of what was serious in intellectual life. In Chicago, for example, there were no textbooks. You didn't read Aristotle said, Freud said. You read Aristotle, you read Freud. And it was chiefly a graduate and professional institution. And I think the undergraduates class maybe was at the most 2,000. And it also had a program which said there are only four things in life really worth doing: being an artist, being a scientist, not a physician, but a scientist doing research, being a statesman, of whom there were none, it was assumed, and the loophole being a teacher of artists, scientists, and statesmen. I fell for that. I came to believe in that. You could be a billionaire, but you were... money didn't matter. You could be a billionaire. You were still a peasant raking gravel in the sun if you didn't devote your life to the good, the true, the beautiful.
You said...
As I say, I bought that not-so-hidden agenda at Chicago.
You said...
The snobbery, the only snobbery in Chicago was intellectual snobbery.
I'm looking at a sentence or two that you wrote. Said... And I love the first approach that you said, my gestalt, a word I would not have used or even known without the University of Chicago, had radically altered. What does gestalt mean?
Mm-hmm. My sense of gestalt is my overall intellectual view of things, of life in general. Speaking of that, you know, I mentioned in a piece I've subsequently wrote about writing my autobiography that I had never heard the word. I don't believe I heard the word intellectual till I was 18. And if you asked me what a man of letters was, I would have said some guy who works at the post office. know, and lo, tricky fate made me both an intellectual and, I guess, a man of letters.
You continue to write that the school had done away, this is University of Chicago, with all conventional forms of snobbery, of birth, wealth, good looks, social fluency, and the only snobbery that survived within its precincts was intellectual. You kind of said that earlier. Why did the school do that?
I think a lot of it was owed to Robert Hutchins, who got some of it from Mortimer Adler, a dubious character. But I think Hutchins decided... Hutchins was a remarkable university president who really decided what the curriculum should be. Nowadays, university presidents do not, as you know, dare enter in and tell a department they shouldn't teach a course because it's frivolous or trivial. But Hutchins, I think, was so powerful of a figure himself that he determined these are the serious things. There was a course at the University of Chicago called Social Science 2, which is, I remember early, you read lots of Plato, you read Aristotle's Constitution of Athens, you read Freud, you read Max Weber. I mean, you read only absolutely first-class things. And it gave you, at least it gave me a kind of confidence that I could read and understand and think about serious things, which wasn't available, I think, at a lot of other schools.
Got some audio of Robert Hutchins, former president of the University of Chicago, and an interesting interview. You can find it on YouTube with Mike Wallace in 1958. Just a minute of it. Let's listen to Robert Hutchins and get your reaction.
Well, education has nothing to do with success in the United States. A child of mine, I won't say a child of yours because such a thought is impossible, but a child of mine who was just above the level of moron could, I'm sure, acquire the diplomas and certificates that were necessary to enable him to get a job and make a comfortable living. So why should we get excited about education? The object of industrialization is to reduce the amount of human effort and intelligence that is put into any single operation. The horror of this situation is not in the fact that morons can be successful, something which I heartily applaud. The horror of the situation is that people who are not morons are doing work that morons could do.
First, what's your reaction to his use of moron? Could he do that kind of thing today?
Oh, absolutely not. Hutchins would not have gotten by the door today. I think it's not possible. Most university presidents, are now devoted almost exclusively, as you know, to fundraising and putting up new buildings that aren't needed. But Hutchins was a shirt sleeve guy, and a lot of what he says, I'm afraid, I subscribe to. I'm sure we've both met very wealthy people who aren't very intelligent, but who can devote themselves wholly and solely to thinking about money.
When did you start thinking, dare I say this, intellectually? When did you start thinking that it mattered to read Plato or any of the people you cite in your book?
I think there's no question about it. It was at Chicago. I think I had some notion. Well, let me go back a bit. When I went to the University of Illinois, as I said, graduating just above the lower quarter of my class, most of the good Jewish boys with whom I went to high school majored in business. And I think they did so because they thought it was a sign of their earnestness, their business, serious. And I would probably have done so, but I feared accounting. I had a sloppy handwriting. I had taken a bookkeeping course in high school, which bored me blue, an azure blue. But I majored in something which I had not heard of till I majored in it, called liberal arts. And I took a poetry course, and I took a French course, and biology, and I got some inkling that this is where the action was for me in intellectual things. But Chicago solidified it.
Where did you grow up, and then where do you live today?
I grew up roughly 2.5 miles from where I live today, 3 miles maybe, in a neighborhood in Chicago called West Rogers Park. It was a neighborhood that was turning from middle class, lower middle class, Lutheran, Catholic, slowly turning Jewish. And over the years that I was growing up, it became more and more Jewish. And today, you should know, it's sort of South Asian with ultra-Orthodox Jews mixed together in it. But it's called West Rogers Park was the neighborhood. And it was a, at first I lived on a street called Sheridan Road, which is one of the main streets in Chicago. It was called merely Rogers Park, and my father, after the war, bought a two-flat building, which was very common in Chicago. The two flats, you bought the building and you rented out the apartment above or below you. But it was when I moved from Rogers Park to West Rogers Park, my life also changed. I was the youngest kid on the block in Rogers Park. And so I played all the four positions. I was a right fielder. I was a center in football. When I moved to West Rogers Park, I suddenly became a shortstop, a T-formation quarterback, a playmaking guard. And I continue to think of myself that way today. I'm still a quarterback and a shortstop in my mind's eye. I should also add that growing up in both places, there was only really one form of distinction, and that was athletic distinction. And unlike the mythical stereotype of Jews being interested in the intellectual life and so forth, in West Rogers Park there was very little of that I saw. I know no Jewish boy who played the violin, for example.
Thank you for doing one thing that nobody's ever done in all the books I've read. You said, my name is Epstein, not Epstein. Tell me why you put that in the book.
Do you know the history of Stein and Steen?
No.
Very quickly, it comes out of World War One, not World War Two, but World War One. There was tremendous anti-German feeling, so great and so irrational even was it, that symphony orchestras wouldn't play Beethoven. Sauerkraut became known as Liberty Cabbage. And suddenly, to have any hint or taint of Germanness in your name even became a problem. So all sorts of Steins, Goldsteins, Silversteins, Epsteins, steened themselves, so to speak. And my father called himself Maurice Epstein. But somehow I like going back to the old Jewish Stein. Somebody who was very touchy about this, as you may or may not know, was Leonard Bernstein, who would actually get ticked off, tell you off, if you called him Bernstein. But the source of the Steinstein matter is World War One, not World War Two, when the Germans really were monstrous.
What does it mean to you, because you do write about it, to being Jewish?
I am a Jewish in the sense of more Jewish than Judaic. I forget who it was who said it was. I think it was one of the Beyond the Fringe. Maybe you've, not Peter Cook, but one of them. Someone said, are you a Jew? And he said, well, actually, I'm Jewish. That is to say, I'm not a very good practicing Jew. But I think of myself I love being a member of the club of Jews, because there's been so many extraordinary people have been Jewish, and the Jewish people have survived so many catastrophes from the beginning of history. I tell my grandchildren, be grateful you're in this extraordinary club, the Jews, it's called. So, and I think it's also conditioned my outlook. One day I recall I was sitting in Israel in the listening to the Israeli symphony, and I looked around the hall and I thought to myself, do you know, everyone in this hall quite possibly is Jewish. And then I thought, you know, I prefer to be in a minority. So maybe that's another part of it is for me, I like to think of myself as always in a minority.
What do you want readers
to... I don't know if that's an answer to your question. I hope so.
No, it is. What do you want readers to get from your autobiography?
Well, I just hope that they'll get some notion of the richness of life, that it's how rich and amusing life can be, and that chiefly, I think, that this sort of perfectly ordinary person had these various turning points in his life, and has been, as I say from the title, I've had a lucky life.
Give us the low point of your life and the high point, or better put, maybe when you, the thing that you enjoyed in your life doing the most.
The low point in my life, I think, was probably the breakup of my first marriage of two. It was pretty dismal stuff. The high point, I should probably say, a more safe answer about the high point should be, haven't reached it yet. But at 87, I suppose I better not say that. I think the most sustained, amusing time of my life, as you began this interview by noting, was high school, which was just sheer fun. And to this day, I go out with the diminishing number of friends in those days. And what we talk about is the good old days. Remember when so-and-so said or so-and-so did this zany, crazy thing?
I first got to know you through your Wall Street Journal essays. And this morning, the day we're recording this, you have one in the journal on the editorial op-ed page. And I want to read you what you said and have you talk some more about it. You say, I wonder if the road downhill in American presidential politics didn't begin in 1960, the first election in which television played a significant role. Expand on that.
Well, I don't know if you'll recall, I suspect you will, that the first presidential debates, were between Nixon and Kennedy. And Nixon failed to shave adequately, you may recall. Or maybe it was the end of the day and he had 5 o'clock shadow. And Kennedy won as much on good looks as anything else. I also think that suddenly, speech writers became central figures around 1960, you know. As I mentioned in the piece, John F. Kennedy won a Pulitzer Prize for a book he never wrote. His most memorable phrase, ask not what you can do for what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, wasn't even his phrase. And the whole Kennedy phenomenon is one there. It's as if America needed a royal family, and we chose the Kennedys. My own view is, of course, it was a very poor choice. Joe Kennedy was a monstrous, the father was a monstrous man, you know, anti-Semitic, wasp-worshipping, a wheeler-dealer of a low type. But somehow it's the sacred name in American politics, still is, I gather.
You're right. The sad fact seems to be that we haven't had an American president that the country has been able to feel good about for more than half of a century.
Yes. Do you disagree with that point?
I don't know that I've thought about it that way, and I usually don't give my views anyway. So,
I won't force them out of you, but there's no... I mean, the closest I can think of is George H.W. Bush, who seemed that, you know, we were sort of the last WASP president. The last WASP was the president, although he tried to feature himself as a Texan, as you may recall. But, you know, Clinton with his sexual hijinks, poor Jimmy Carter, who's what I think of as his misplaced Christianity. It's not been an impressive group of men whom we've elected president. Over all those years, and it's a sadness, I think.
But you do say that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, so too J. William Fulbright.
Well, he was an astonishing man, in that I think he sort of served both parties. He was a man of of great intellectual power. He used to call me from time to time to discuss things like Emil Durkheim. When I was editor of the magazine, The American Scholar, he published a few essays there. He just sent them to me, and he could write well. I think he was a truly impressive human being. There's a story that I rather like. Moynihan had written a report saying we didn't have a health crisis. We have health problems in this country, but it doesn't amount to a crisis. And he was about to publish it when he heard from the Clinton White House that he must not publish it because President Clinton was about to give an important speech about our health crisis. And Moynihan just said, I hate that unreality of life, that, you know, that this guy's decided there's a crisis when there's not, and so I can't say it's not. He was a man with a real sense of reality and impressive in so many ways. And also a terrific laugh, by the way.
We have, you have in this column other names that I'll mention in a moment, but you say you're not a Republican nor a Democrat. You're part of the anti-BS party.
Yes, well, I think the two parties are in miserable shape right now, and I don't like to think of myself affiliating with either. I started out in life as a fairly radical left-wing person. Maybe I picked that up at Chicago. But when I started teaching at Northwestern University, I saw how little the politics really affected the lives of the people who claimed to be liberals. And so that sort of set me off the other way.
The other names you mention in your column, they're quite diverse. Some people would be surprised that you list J. William Fulbright, Robert A. Taft, Paul mm-hmm. Douglas, the former senator from Illinois, and then you go on to talk about Dwight Eisenhower. What did you see in Fulbright, Taft, and Douglas?
Douglas was an impressive man in every way. You may recall Douglas joined, I think, the Marines at like age 43 during World War II. And there was never any you had the sense about all three men that they really believed what they said. You don't have the sense these days that politicians believe what they say. I mentioned Reagan, I think, who was much beloved by the conservatives, but I don't think he was all that great a man. The conservatives need a figure to revere. But Reagan believed communism was evil, and he was right. But you don't have the sense that Biden believes in what he says, or Trump really believes. They just believe in themselves and in power.
You did not get a PhD, but you were hired at Northwestern, taught there for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Why no PhD, and how did you get into the classroom?
I was never good at school. In fact, I've come to learn, come to believe that the best education is teaching, not studenting. It didn't occur to me to get a PhD, which involved a lot of slog work. And the way I got into Northwestern was I was freelancing. I was trying to make my living writing, which I was doing. And then one day, Irving Howe, who was the literary critic and the editor of Dissent magazine, came to town. He was going to give a talk at Northwestern. And Irving Howe, I had written a few things for his magazine, Dissent. I was then in my early 30s, maybe just 30. And he said, you ought to take a job teaching. I said, well, I'd like to, but I have no advanced degrees. And Howe said, let me see what I can do. And he apparently went to the chairman of the Northwestern English Department. He must have said, there's an interesting character living in your town in Evanston named Joseph Epstein. He may be important someday. You ought to think about hiring him. And lo, this guy did. And it was a friend of mine named Walter Scott said, when I got the job, he said, welcome to the rackets.
What did he mean?
Teaching is a wonderful wonderful deal in that, you know, it's about a six-month job, really, if you think of all the reading weeks and the long summers. And in some ways, it's the perfect job for a writer.
You're somewhat critical in your book about Northwestern University. What did you say, and why did you say it?
Well, I think Northwestern is a... First of all, let me say something. I was at Northwestern for 30 years, and I emerged with one friend after 30 years. And I hope, as this conversation between us conveys, I'm not entirely an unfriendly person. But I wrote things when I was at Northwestern that so apparently upset my colleagues that when I passed them in the hall, they didn't know where to put their eyes. And Northwestern, I learned subsequently after leaving Northwestern that one of the presidents there, a man named Arnold Weber, apparently had issued a diktat saying that I was not to be fired. I never had tenure at Northwestern. I was on a kind of year-to-year basis. And I think, but for Arnold Weber, they probably would have fired me long before. But in my simple life, if you're a writer and you can't say what you believe, what really is the point of writing at all? An example of my troublemaking is I was on a panel for small magazine editors in Los Angeles, and at some point I said on this panel that a good part of the country is just reelected Ronald Reagan, but meanwhile universities like my own at Northwestern are trying to hire Marxist teachers. There's a man named Frederick Jacobson, I said, who's a self-avowed Marxist, and Northwestern's made him a very handsome offer, has made his wife an offer, and I don't know, it's rumored, I don't know if it's true or not, but they apparently offered the Jameson's dog 18-5 to guard Patton Gymnasium. Well, it got into the press, that remark, and my raise for that year was $400.
You write, Northwestern students had what I came to think the habits of achievement. That is, they did what was asked of them, told to read a 500-page novel over a period of 5 or 6 days. They did so. Asked to write a 10-page paper over a weekend. They produced the paper. They were what I came to think of as, quote, good at school, unquote, a skill without any necessary carryover, like being good at pole vaulting or playing the harmonica.
Yes, there are kids who can do school, but in fact, the real students one hopes for, and I had a number of them at Northwestern, were those who were really passionate about intellectual things, who thought there was something at stake. But I also must tell you that a lot of kids at Northwestern was their fallback school. They really wanted, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, I once said to my son, he said the one piece of good advice I gave him, only one, notice. I said, if you can arrange it, try to get into a good college or university. You'll go there, you'll find it isn't so good, but at least you won't spend the rest of your life saying, oh, if only I'd gotten into a good school, how different my life would have been. But I tend to think a lot of universities these days, well, not these days, but for a long while, is about snobbery. You know, there's nothing, I noticed when my sons were 18 and 19, people would say, oh, you have children 18, 19, where do they go to school? And the answers, you know, they just registered whether you were a successful parent or not. If you could say Harvard, Yale, Princeton, winning, as opposed to having to say Arizona State, Western, they have a good photojournalism school. But nowadays, of course, the schools are, all these universities are marred by DEI, as you know, diversity, equity, and inclusivity, which somebody not long ago called, DEI stands for didn't earn it.
Joe Epstein, what do you think of DEI?
I think it's baloney. I think it's a sadness that we have to rely on that and that we can't take people on their merit. When I was at Northwestern, there was a very left-wing woman named Barbara Foley who, it was said, gave all black students A's. It was her own personal reparations program. Not good. Not good for black students, I think.
You tell us when you started teaching that you had to decide what people could call you and what you would call students. Explain that.
Yes. Well, to begin with, I remember the very first class I had was I called the roll, and I came to a boy named Faustin. It was his first name, Faustin Pipel. And he said, "Sir, do you mind calling me Frosty?" And at that moment, I decided I would call no student by his first name, lest I begin have class and say, well, Muffin, what do you think Frosty said? What about you, Cookie? You know, are you the same as Chip? You know, so I called students Mr. and Miss, and it was thought quite strange to do so. One student said to me, "Nobody at Princeton ever called me by my last name. It's amazing." And but they just called me Mr. Epstein. I would frequently get calls, Dr. Epstein, and I always wanted to say, read two chapters of Henry James and get right into bed. I'll be over in 20 minutes.
What did you ever wear blue jeans in your class?
No, I haven't owned blue jeans since high school. I always made it a point to wear a jacket and tie. In fact, one of my few regrets about teaching is on my last day of teaching, I wished I had taken off my jacket and revealed a shoulder holster, but I failed to do it.
You stepped in a little controversy about Dr. Biden.
Yes. It shows how goofy and sensitive the world is. I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that Dr. Jill Biden really shouldn't call herself doctor, that it's a Bush League thing to do. At Chicago, nobody called him or herself doctor. And these are people who had, you know, serious degrees. And I wrote about it in what I thought was a high-spirited and slightly amusing way. And, wow, the letters came pouring in, especially, by the way, from young women. And I think what I really attacked was, without meaning to, was their sense of how important their own degrees were to them. You know, their MAs and their PhDs and all that stuff. And not of the least interest, the language with which I was attacked was powerfully dirty.
On October the
3rd... One woman called me a Jewish female genitalia.
Interesting.
Something I've not been called before.
On October the 31st, 1990, Mortimer Adler was here in our studios. And here's a minute and 12 seconds of what he says, and I want you to tell us what it all means.
Okay.
Every year in the United States, there are 40,000 books published. Of those 40,000, not 1,000 are worth reading once, carefully. Maybe 809, but 1,000 is the limit. The number of books out of the 40,000 are worth reading carefully. Of those 1,000, probably not 100 or less than 100 are worth reading carefully twice. Of those that are worth reading carefully twice, probably not one in every 5 years is worth reading carefully three times. A great book is worth reading carefully again and again and again for a lifetime. There are lots of good books published every year, but they're relevant to one or two or three ideas. The great books are relevant to 100 ideas, 85 ideas, it's always more than 25. The great books are always relevant to every generation. for the last 2,500 years. We don't regard them as archaeological relics. We regard them as contemporary books, always dealing with our problems today.
Who was Mortimer Adler?
Well, Mortimer Adler was Mortimer Adler came out of Columbia, and he picked up the great books notion from a man at Columbia named John Erskine, and he sort of brought it to Chicago, and he brought it with, you know, he was advised Hutchins on a lot of matter of this kind, and he published, Mortimer did, a set of books called The Great Books, with what he also called a syntopicon, which touched on where the great books touch on what he determined were 102 great ideas. I've written a sort of attack on Mortimer called The Great Bookie, in which I say that he was really an indexer in philosopher's clothes. I worked with and for Mortimer for about three or so years, and he was the perfect person who sort of lived intellectually high ground, and on low ground was always foolish. There was a wonderful story that was told to me about Mortimer was pursuing a woman, and he decided to write love poetry to her, and he was sitting writing on a legal pad, and he one page after another he'd tear up and throw in the wastebasket. Finally, he went off to lunch, and the secretary went in to see what he was writing. And the poem that he was writing began with the word "whereas." Mortimer apparently divorced his first wife. He called in his divorce. He was somebody who was wonderfully impractical, but he had boundless energy for the great ideas. He felt that if you mastered the great books and the Encyclopedia Britannica, which he reorganized and I think ruined in some way, that was all the education you needed. He also believed everyone was educable. Everyone could live on this high intellectual level, which I think is sort of foolish. In fact, he used to teach at Aspen in the summers, and I remember he was teaching John Locke, and he said to a friend of mine, "This book is too good for those swine, the people, you know, the executives who came to Aspen in the summer." So Mortimer was a true character in some way.
Another man you talk about is Alan Bloom, the author of The Closing of the American Mind. Here he is speaking on behalf of disadvantaged groups, interview with Richard Hefner. This was June 7, 1987, about a minute.
I'm speaking, you know, on behalf of a disadvantaged group, a certain kind of student in America who has longings, or philosophical longings, and that I think is being deprived of the atmosphere.
A very small group.
It's a very small group, but it's always very important in a society. Most people aren't philosophic. They're too involved with other things. But it's very important that there be a broader vision somewhere, because that always... I mean, the marvelous thing about American society is you could really be almost anything you wanted to be, at least in thought. But what you needed to have was the idea of what you might be. And my sense of the impoverished curriculum is it's leaving anybody do what they want, but they have lost the alternatives which would allow them to find out what they could really be.
Who was Alan Bloom, and what did you think of what he said?
Well, what he said was impressive. Alan was a student, was one of the great figures to come out of the University of Chicago. He was a student of Leo Strauss. He was a disciple, and he himself tried to make disciples in his teaching. Alan was much more impressive if you didn't know him. I knew him, and he was... in some ways, a comic character. He seemed never to wear less than about $4,000 worth of clothes, over which he'd spilled rib sauce and every other thing. I remember he came to my friend Edward Shills one day. I was there, and he said that he was terribly worried that some poll had shown the world was not going his way by 4 points. And Edward Shills said to him, "Alan, You've not read many books, it's true, but you've read 30 or 40 of the world's best books, enough to know that nobody gives a damn about a poll. Now go home and reread those books yet again, Alan. Alan became a friend of Saul Bellow's, and Saul Bellow featured Alan, as you may know, in the his last novel, Ravelstein. Not Steen, notice, Ravelstein.
Yes.
And he was, in a way, if you knew him, he was a kind of comic character, but he was a passionate teacher, and he did enlist disciples to his own thought.
What did you teach?
The closing of the American Mind made Alan a millionaire also, which allowed him to, he did things like he bought a BMW and seemed to have forgotten that he didn't know how to drive.
What did you teach during your 30 years?
I taught mostly novels, courses in Henry James, Joseph Conrad, Willa Cather. I also taught a regular course in something called Advanced Prose Composition, in which I took up for would-be writers. There was a writing program at Northwestern. Usually there were smallish classes, never more, I think, than 40 students. In the writing courses, it was usually 15 or so. And I've had some talented students who've gone on to do good things as editors and as writers on their own right. Jonathan Eich, a young man who just published a long biography of Martin Luther King, and before that wrote a biography of Muhammad Ali, was a student of mine. A critic named Donna Rifkin was a student of mine. A man named Paul Glastris, who went on to edit the magazine Washington Monthly, was a student who happened in my class. A novelist named Karen Russell. So I was not unlucky. I had maybe 20 students with whom I'm still in touch. In fact, the editor of my autobiography was a student of mine, a man named Robert Messenger, who was extraordinarily bright as a young man.
You mentioned Edward Shields. You talk a lot about him in your book. Who was he? What impact did
Edward
he have on you?
Edward Shields was a social scientist at the University of Chicago and an extraordinary man. He spent half his life in England. During World War II, he served the army. His mastery of German was complete. Apparently, he quizzed captured German soldiers and so forth and so on. And he stayed in England for a while. And he taught at the London School of Economics. And later, he became a fellow at Peterhouse College at Cambridge. Edward's father was a cigar maker in Philadelphia, and he grew up a kind of a working-class Jewish boy. But when he died, someone from the London Times called me about his obituary and said, he came from railroad money, did he not? So completely had Edward sort of remade himself, or as we say today, reinvented himself. He had a mid-Atlantic accent. He was devastatingly witty. And immensely smart. He was one of the central characters on the Committee of Social Thought at the University of Chicago. And I met Edward Edward was, I think, 27 years older than I. And he was another character who made me feel how both serious and amusing the world could be. And I'm forever grateful for having met him and feel fortunate that he decided I was okay. That I could be his friend, which I was, and we spoke almost every week, and dined out. And he was an extraordinary human being.
I'm close enough to your age that I can, I think I can ask you this. Did you ever think through the years? I mean, you're 87 years old, and you don't miss a beat in our conversations. You just wrote a book. You write a column for the Wall Street Journal. And I'm sure you've known plenty of people that are in the 80s who lose their, I don't want to say it the way it sounds, lose their mind through Alzheimer's and other things. Did you ever expect to have complete control of your brain at this age?
I don't think it's a question that occurred to me. As I began to answer your question, you couldn't hear it. I knocked on wood, and I feel extremely lucky to be able to be functioning, you know, in a way that I seem to be, you know, writing. And I should also tell you that as a writer, there are people who can write extremely well. I think of George Kennan and others, but don't need to write. But I think there's a kind of writer, of whom I'm one, who needs to write. When I say needs to write, what I mean is someone who, if he's not writing, feels he's not really living. So I'm very lucky that I still seem to be able to do this. And there are people who still want to read what I write. And I just touched wood again. But I hadn't thought. Somehow I hadn't thought so much about what I would be like in my 80s.
You write about this in kind of a different way. George Santana remarked that one of the reasons older people often grow grumpy about the world is that with the presentiment of their own death, they can't see what good the world can be without them in it.
Yes, there is something about growing older where I don't know if it's a natural. I don't want to call it grumpiness, but one sort of slides out of it. Very recently, last night, there was Joe Biden had a fundraising function. And it was advertised as featuring Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and star-studded other celebrants to come. And they showed the star-studded celebrants, I think 8 or 9 of them. I knew one. So one falls out of it. And it doesn't seem unpleasant not to know who, you know, the singer Lizzo is, or things of that kind. Whether that's the onset of dementia or not, I don't know. But I find I do a lot of things in the last 10 or so years that I fail to do that I used to. I don't go to the movies very much anymore. I don't know the top 10 songs. They're things I once prided myself on being up to date and with it. So one of the nice things about being old is you can be happily out of it.
I have several things, quick questions, and get your answer on, because you talk about them. You say you're a pious agnostic.
Yes. What I mean by that is I think religion is terribly important, and I'm only an agnostic because I can't make the leap into faith. But I envy those people who have true faith and who feel they know where they're going when death arrives.
What do you think of tenure in universities?
That's an interesting and tough question. I think it's useful only insofar as it protects people who need protection.
Did you ever want it? Did you ever ask for it?
No. It was never remotely up for offer in my case.
What was your style of teaching?
It was, I once said, it was Socratic. Although I dressed better than Socrates, I wasn't as smart. But it was mostly filling kids in on general things and then questioning them.
You say you
I used to say in a German accent, "We have ways of making good talk."
You say you wrote, I think, 92 essays under the title of Aristides?
Correct.
Explain that. Why the name, and what kind of essays were they, and where did you publish them?
Well, when I became editor of the American Scholar, I'm grasping for the date now. I think it was 1973. I decided to have a column at the front of each quarterly issue, and I decided instead of having my name, I would choose the name Aristides. Aristides, you may remember, was the Athenian political figure who was finally sent away from Athens He was called Aristides the Just, and the joke line was, people grew tired of always hearing him called the Just, and I thought people would grow tired of my writing this column. But I wrote, it was about 6,500 words each quarter, and I seemed never to fall out of subjects for it. And I wrote 92 such essays.
You have four boys.
Pardon?
You have...
I had two stepsons, and I had two sons of my own.
And you write about you lost a son at one point. What was that about?
Well, it was he died from an overdose of opioids, I believe, at the age of 28. And I won't say any more about it because it's too sad making. If you'll forgive me.
How much in touch are you with your children today?
I'm not in very close touch at all with my stepsons. My own oldest son, Mark, and I are in touch regularly. He has a capacious and interesting mind. I think I say in the book, if I don't, I should have done. There's an Arab proverb that says, when your son becomes a man, make him your brother. And my son Mark and I are like brothers. The only question is, if you were to hear us talking, you'd say he was the older brother. He's very smart and very amusing.
How long have you been married to your second wife, and where did you meet her?
I've been married a mere 47 years, which suggests that the marriage might last. And I met her at Encyclopedia Britannica, where we both worked.
You list a lot of people that you, I think you suggest you knew them. Jacques Barzun, Clifton Fadiman, William Benton, Lionel Trilling, mm-hmm. Mark Van Doren, and Norman Podhoretz. There are others, but I mentioned the Mark Van Doren because of his son, Charles. What was that story, and did you know Charles Van Doren?
Yes, I didn't know Mark Van Doren, and I didn't know Lionel Trilling very well. I'd been introduced to him. I knew his wife, Diana, who was on the editorial board of the American Scholar. But I knew Fadiman and Jacques Barzun. I knew Jacques both from the American Scholar, and he did some work for Britannica. There was a kind of Columbia mafia in those days, and all those figures that you mentioned were part of it. They got each other jobs and stuff. But Charles Van Doren had his great scandal, as you know, the great quiz show scandal, where he'd been given the questions beforehand, and he did a terrific acting job struggling to pretend to dig for the answers to these questions. And he was once on the cover of Time magazine when that meant a lot. And he worked at Britannica. He worked for Mortimer Adler and for Britannica. And I would go to lunch with Charlie from time to time. And he was a strange guy. First of all, you didn't want to get into an argument with him because you had such a moral advantage over poor Charlie. You could always, if the argument went too deep, you could say, of course, what would you know? You're a national BSer. You've been caught out at it. He was a national disgrace, poor Charlie.
From your book, you write, if a friend wishes to confess to me, and many have, I am honored by the trust and intimacy he is bestowing upon me with the act, but I do not feel it need to be returned.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this has to do in part with my autobiography generally. The confessional is not one of my favorite modes. I don't think I have anything all that interesting to confess.
Why did you think you had something interesting to write about when it came to your life?
I just thought that I had, at this point in my life, I think I'm getting the knack for writing after 30 books, and that I thought I had the equipment to make my life seem interesting. If whether it is or not is up to readers to judge. But it seemed time to do it if ever I was to do it.
In my
mid-80s at that point.
Of all your books, which one sold the most?
The one that sold the most, I think, is Snobbery. I think the publication date was 2002. and it had a very good run of sales. A book that keeps selling, Snobbery does not in the same way, is a book of short stories I wrote called Fabulous Small Jews. And I noticed that I get royalty checks. I call them peasantries because they don't amount to that much, a few hundred dollars. But every year, you know, 20-odd years after I wrote it, it keeps selling over the years.
Okay, one last question. Mm-hmm. 2008, why a book about Fred Astaire?
The answer is going to be disappointing to you. Because I was asked to do it. Yale University Press was writing was running a series of books on what they call the book. The word wasn't quite the cliche. It's since become on icons. And I thought they asked me to choose one, and I chose Fred Astaire, whose film life I've always admired tremendously.
The book is called Never Say You've Had a Lucky Life, especially if you've had a lucky life.
Exactly.
Last question to you. Was that your idea for the title?
It was.
Our guest has been Joseph Epstein. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a pleasant interview.
Thanks for listening to the Book Notes Plus podcast. Please rate and review Book Notes Plus, and don't forget to follow so you never miss an episode. Questions or comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.